Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Nakba happened in 1948. The Nakba continues in the present today in Gaza. The Nakba must be stopped in Gaza, and the Nakba must be reversed in the long run.
Palestinians across the globe mark the 76th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, or catastrophe, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled or were forced from their homes upon Israel's founding. We'll speak with a Palestinian historian. Then we hear from a doctor who saved the life of Senator Tammy Duckworth 20 years ago when she was injured in Iraq. He's now part of an American medical delegation trapped at the European hospital in Khan Yunis.
What we want is not only for us to leave. We seem to we're here because we have not been granted safe passage. We're supposed to leave after 2 weeks, and that date has passed. Normally, it's coordinated between the UN and the IDF, and this is not. We have been not given the green light, so we cannot really leave the hospital safely. We've been told that if we do, then we basically are responsible for anything that happens to us.
But first, House Speaker Mike Johnson is the highest level Republican official yet to visit the criminal hush money election interference trial of former President Donald Trump underway in New York.
This is the fifth week that President Trump has been in court for this sham of a trial. They are doing intentionally to keep him here and keep him off of the campaign trail. And I think everybody in the country can see that for what it is.
On Tuesday, Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, testified, discussed hush money repayments with Trump in the Oval Office. And over 500 faculty and staff at the City College of New York demand charges be dropped against students and faculty arrested last month. Many of those arrested face felony charges more serious than those faced by those arrested at Columbia and Barnard. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's notified Congress of plans to send another $1 billion in arms to Israel, including tank ammunition, mortars, and tactical vehicles. The move comes as President Biden faces criticism from Israel and Republican lawmakers for pausing a single shipment of large bombs to Israel last week. The new $1 billion arms package is being advanced as Israel's widening its assault on Rafah and other areas of Gaza. More than 550,000 Palestinians have been displaced in recent days. The death toll has topped 35,100. The Palestinian Authority says 80% of Gaza's health centers are out of service due to Israeli attacks. This all comes as Palestinians across the globe are marking the 76th anniversary of the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, when some 700,000 Palestinians were violently expelled from their homes upon Israel's founding. Many Palestinians say they're facing a second Nakba today. This is Hussein Junaid, who had to flee the Jabalia refugee camp.
They deported us from the north of Gaza Strip. Here we are thrown on the streets. They destroyed our houses. They killed four children. They were martyred, among them a doctor and a head of department. My four older children died. They were martyred. Our homes were destroyed. They shook us and they threw us on the streets. Who is looking for us? Which organization? Which area? And which government? Let them see that we are thrown on the streets with our children and small ones who don't have milk and want food.
In the occupied West Bank, Palestinian truck drivers say they fear for their lives after Jewish settlers attacked a convoy of 98 Gaza-bound aid trucks Monday.
We went to the checkpoint, and after the check, we were surprised to see settlers on the roundabout of the checkpoint. They damaged the cars, they tore the tires off the trucks, they threw the contents of the truck on the ground. We gathered some of the products and sent some of those products onto a bulldozer and sent them to the sheep farms. Around 15 trucks were damaged. Their hull was damaged, windows of the trucks were broken, some drivers were beaten, some of the products were thrown away, and the whole loss for Hebron is around $2 million.
While Palestinians are marking the Nakba, Israelis have been celebrating their Independence Day. On Tuesday, a group of far-right Israelis, including a number of government ministers, marched in Sderot, calling for the resettlement of Gaza and the expulsion of Palestinians living there. Speakers included Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar, who said, quote, "We must return to Gaza now." He also backed what he called the, quote, "voluntary migration of Palestinians from Gaza." Protests over Israel's war in Gaza are continuing across the United States. In Mountain View, California, hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters blocked the entrances to a Google conference for software developers. Ariel Koren is a former Google worker.
We are sending a message that Google is the company that is providing the cloud infrastructure for Israel's violent crimes against humanity. And so we will hold the company accountable for this behavior. There is no reason, there is no need for Google to profit off of genocide. And so our demands, they're not radical, they're not difficult. It's really simple. Drop Project Nimbus and drop business with the government and the military of Israel that is guilty of genocide.
Nice to see you again.
Here in New York, students at CUNY, the City University of New York, briefly took over a library at the Graduate Center Tuesday night and renamed it Al-Aqsa University Library to honor Gaza's oldest public university, which was destroyed by Israel. At Harvard University, students have ended their three-week Gaza encampment after school officials agreed to meet to discuss divesting from Israel. Isra Al-Zamli is a student organizer at Harvard.
We've been organizing for Palestine on Harvard's campus for years. This encampment was not the beginning or the end of our organizing, but it was a beautiful moment of showing how much student power we can build. You know, President Garver has made it very clear from the beginning that he had no interest in negotiating with us, but we showed that we had the student power to actually bring him to discussions.
Case and the criminal hush money and election interference trial of former President Donald Trump. On Tuesday, Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, admitted he misled the Federal Election Commission about hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Cohen said he did so in order to, quote, demonstrate loyalty to Mr. Trump, unquote. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senator J.D. Vance, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum were among a number of Trump allies to show up at the New York courthouse Tuesday and do what Trump can't do, bash the prosecution, attack Michael Cohen's testimony. Primaries were held Tuesday in Maryland, Nebraska, and West Virginia. In Maryland, Angela Alsobrook won the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate in her bid to become the first black senator from Maryland. She defeated three-term Democratic Congressmember David Trone. He spent 10 times as much money, over $60 million of his personal fortune, on the race to replace Ben Cardin, who's retiring. Former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan won the Republican primary. In another closely watched Maryland race, State Senator Sarah Elfreth won a crowded Democratic House primary to fill the seat of John Sarbanes, who's also retiring. A super PAC funded by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or APAC, spent $4 million to help her campaign. In West Virginia, Republican Governor Jim Justice and Democrat Glenn Elliott won their respective Senate primaries Tuesday, setting up a face-off in November to fill the seat of Democrat Joe Manchin. Ukrainian forces are withdrawing from some areas in the northeastern region of Kharkiv as Russian forces continue a new offensive that has displaced thousands. The Ukrainian city of Vovchansk is reportedly in ruins following relentless Russian shelling. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has postponed all of his upcoming foreign travel amidst the new Russian offensive. On Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken visited Kyiv and vowed more U.S. assistance would be coming. Lawmakers in the Republic of Georgia have passed a controversial foreign influence bill that will require NGOs and news organizations to register as foreign agents if they receive at least 20% of their funding from abroad. Critics say the bill uses Kremlin-inspired measures to crush dissent and moves Georgia away from Europe and closer to Moscow. The bill has sparked weeks of street protests. President Biden's announced new tariffs on $18 billion of Chinese imports, including electric vehicles and solar cells. The tariffs on electric vehicles will increase to 100% in an effort to prevent Chinese electric cars from being sold in the United States, in a move that critics say contradicts Biden's pledge to combat the climate crisis by transitioning away from gas-powered vehicles. The Chinese government condemned the new tariffs, saying the moves will, quote, severely affect the atmosphere for bilateral cooperation, unquote. The U.S. Justice Department has determined Boeing has violated the terms of a 2021 deferred prosecution deal that was reached after the fatal crashes of two 737 MAX planes in Ethiopia and Indonesia that killed all 346 people on board. The DOJ's determination could reopen the door to the government prosecuting Boeing, which has been plagued by safety issues on its planes. And in Florida, at least eight migrant farm workers from Mexico died in a bus accident as they headed on farm. 40 other farm workers were injured. The accident occurred when a truck collided with the bus carrying the workers. The driver of the truck has been arrested and charged with driving under the influence, manslaughter. In a statement, the Farm Worker Association of Florida said, quote, farm workers tend to be forgotten, but it's important not to forget farm workers, especially during such difficult times, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with the criminal hush money election interference trial of former President Donald Trump. New York prosecutors are wrapping up their case that alleges Trump falsified business records in an illegal effort to influence the 2016 presidential election when he allegedly hid the reimbursement of a hush money payment to his lawyer, Michael Cohen, made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. On Tuesday, Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, admitted he misled the Federal Election Commission about hush money payments made to Daniels. Cohen said he did so in order to, quote, demonstrate loyalty to Mr. Trump, unquote, and described a February 2017 meeting with President Trump in the Oval Office at the White House about the hush money repayment. Cohen also recalled Trump trying to stop him from cooperating with federal investigators. In cross-examination, Trump's defense attorneys tried to suggest Cohen was motivated by vengeance against Trump. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senator J.D. Vance, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, and others were among a number of allies of President Trump who visited the courthouse Tuesday to bash the Michael Cohen. This is Speaker Johnson.
This is the fifth week that President Trump has been in court for this sham of a trial. They are doing this intentionally to keep him here and keep him off of the campaign trail. And I think everybody in the country can see that for what it is.
This comes as a New York appeals court rejected Trump's request to overturn a gag order against him in the case. For more, we're joined by Ron Kuby, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York, closely following all Trump's cases. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ron. Talk about the significance of this week. You had Stormy Daniels testifying last week. Now you have Michael Cohen. The prosecutors began, and then he has been grilled by Trump's defense attorneys.
Michael Cohen essentially is the narrator of the entire case. He's the person who has come forward. He's tied all the disparate pieces together, the documents, Stormy Daniels, and everything else the prosecution has introduced. And he is the one who has firsthand knowledge of the actual deal that he and Donald Trump struck in order to pay the hush money, create a phony retainer, and ultimately falsify the business records. And while his credibility is important, And I think that most people can agree that he's a loathsome lackey. He was a loathsome lackey for Donald Trump. And he's just the other mob underboss who gets called in a criminal trial. Although he's not as bad as the average mob underboss. He didn't actually kill anybody, arsonate anybody on behalf of his boss. But he is a guy who would have taken a bullet for the boss, did all these things for the boss. Then the boss betrayed him. And now he indeed is out for revenge. Unfortunately for Donald Trump, and I hate to start a sentence like that, but unfortunately for Donald Trump, the story that Michael Cohen tells is an eminently believable story and is corroborated in significant respects. So the defense is going to have a hard time with him, all the more so because Trump's lead lawyer has never tried a criminal case in state court and has only defended two criminal cases in his entire life. This is not the on-the-job training, learning case that you really want sort of starting out in the world of New York criminal defense.
And Rod, first of all, greetings. It's been a long time since we've talked. But I wanted to ask you about two things. One is you're a veteran of decades of criminal cases. Do you ever recall political leaders from Washington coming to a local criminal case like this, like the Speaker of the House and these other members of Congress and publicly criticizing the prosecution in the midst of a trial? And secondly, you've had a lot to say about the media coverage of this trial. So I'm wondering if you could comment on both the politicians involved in this case and also the way the media have covered it.
Unfortunately, Juan, I have seen this before. It's the advantage or disadvantage of being around as long as I've been around. We saw it, for example, and I don't know how many people even remember this, the Bernard Goetz case. Deranged white man carrying around a handgun, shot down four black youth who he encountered in the subway. The subway vigilante had huge support. We had people like Senator Alphonse D'Amato coming to his defense, showing up at his trial. Of course, the Rudy Giuliani showing up and other political leaders. When there is a high profile case and you see elements that are attractive to really one side or the other, usually the right wing, they tend to show up and use the trial as a background to posture for their views. Mike Johnson, it was kind of remarkable in the sense that he did one of the things that Trump specifically was doing. He attacked the judge's daughter, which was kind of amazing. And as for Mike Johnson, remember, he's the guy who publicly announced that he and his son are internet buddies. They monitor each other's internet traffic to make sure that none of them are looking at porn or off-color websites. I wonder how Mike and Mike Jr. dealt with Stormy Daniels. Was anybody tempted to Google her body of work there, or did they just stay on the straight and narrow? It was a pretty disgusting show all around from Mike Johnson. The media coverage of the case, they tend to view this as a sporting event. The prosecution scored heavily here. The danger with that is we have no idea who's ahead or who's behind until the jury speaks. In a sporting event, you can say, okay, the Yankees are up by 9 runs in the 7th inning. They have never lost with this much of a lead, and you can confidently predict, happily, the Yankees will win. But you can't do that with a criminal trial. So much of this speculation is just uninformed because it can't be informed. And, of course, the next body of uninformed speculation will be, will Donald Trump testify? Donald Trump will not testify. I think we should speculate on the reasons he's going to use to explain why he's not testifying. And I have, you know, my own selection on my bingo card. But of course, he's not going to testify.
And Judge Merchan, I wanted to ask you, if he is convicted, your sense of the likelihood of him imposing a jail sentence?
Judge Merchan is notoriously harsh on white-collar criminals. Judge Merchan is one of these judges who seems to think that the more you have, the more you've accumulated, the more advantages and privilege you've had in your life, the more you should really follow the rules. Because the rules make it, you know, easy enough for you to become wealthy. Like, if you're violating them out of greed or personal motivation, you will be sentenced to jail. So I have no doubt that Judge Merchan will impose a prison sentence. I also have no doubt that that prison sentence and the conviction will be stayed while Donald Trump pursues a whole plethora of multiple appeals.
I wanted to ask you about where you're going today to court to represent the climate activists arrested on Earth Day in front of Citibank headquarters. Many are now appearing in court. And also to ask you about the pro-Palestinian student activists at Purchase. I think 68 were arrested. This is State University of New York. Westchester DA said many of the charges will be dropped against them, as well as the students arrested at Fordham. You're representing all of these people.
Okay. So from the top, this morning in criminal court, in the summons appearance part, the climate protesters who were part of the New York Communities for Change set of actions. It's getting hot out there. It's going to be a hot summer. Actions. Young people, for the most part, climate protesters desperately trying to get into people's consciousness about the existential need to save this planet, which has always been a difficult thing because people tend to look at the crisis of today and tomorrow rather than the crisis of a year from now. Unfortunately, today is now. The future is now. And so they are all charged with criminal trespass. I expect those charges will be dismissed. Following that, there are three Palestinian protesters at 100 Center Street today who disrupted the Easter vigil at St. Patrick's Cathedral in a respectful but firm protest against the slaughter in Gaza. Yesterday, the Purchase students began their series of appearances, and they are, for the most part, taking a three-hour course called Fresh Start. Nice. And all of those charges were be dismissed. And the Fordham students are due on Monday, also in the summons part, where they face trespass charges. And it is likely those cases will ultimately be dismissed as well. I don't think I've missed anybody.
I want to thank you, Ron. Go ahead, Ron.
I just wanted to ask, Ron, you for decades, of course, you have been one of the go-to lawyers in New York for social protesters, and especially during your period of partnership with the late, great William Kunstler. I'm wondering, seen over these years, this kind of upsurge of young people protesting like you've seen in the last couple of years?
It's a great question. I tend to view these struggles at very much the way William Kunstler did, as perennial struggles with each generation kind of rising up to do their part. We saw that in Occupy Wall Street. We see it now. And I just have mad respect for the young people who are literally risking their education, their careers, and their futures to stand up for the planet, to stand up against the slaughter in Gaza. And it's so impressive to see them. And I'm always happy to serve those movements in any small way that I can.
Ron Kuby, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York. Next up, we go to Gaza to speak with an American doctor who saved the life of Senator Tammy Duckworth 20 years ago when she was injured in Iraq. He's now part of an American medical volunteer delegation at European Hospital in Khan Yunis, who's trapped. Stay with us.
What you coming about, baby? Are you getting lazy? Clear blue sky, but it rains all the late fees. Did you get the payment? We had an arrangement. We don't want to watch the news. We just read statements. Yeah, do you
Hey!
by 100 gigs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As many as 20 American doctors and healthcare workers on a medical mission at the European hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza are trapped after Israel closed the Rafah border crossing into Egypt. The Intercept reported on the Palestinian American Medical Association situation Monday, describing, quote, Monica Johnston, a nurse volunteering at the hospital, said a primary concern of those who will be leaving is that new humanitarian workers be allowed in. Otherwise, the hospital campus is more likely to get overrun by the Israel Defense Forces. The plan, she said, is for the UN to do a test run from the hospital to the border Tuesday, only carrying UN staff. If those staff are not killed by the IDF, as one international employee was on Monday, then on Wednesday, two medical staff will be taken to the border and two new volunteers will be allowed in to replace them and so on in the coming days, she said. For an update, we're joined by Dr. Adam Hamawi. He is a plastic surgeon, Army veteran from New Jersey, who's part of the volunteer mission with the Palestinian American Medical Association at European Hospital in Khan Yunis. 20 years ago, in 2004, he saved the life of Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois when she was struck by a rocket-propelled grenade while serving in the Iraq War, losing both of her legs and partial use of her right arm. She told NBC News Tuesday, quote, we're shaking every tree, calling everyone to make sure we do everything we can to ensure safe passage of these doctors to whatever crossing we can get them to, Senator Duckworth said. Dr. Hamawi, thanks so much for being with us. Explain where you are and the situation you're in right now.
Thank you very much for having me. I am in the European Hospital in Gaza, which is in Khan Yunis on the border of Rafah. We've been over here over about 2 weeks now, and we are continuing to work the best we can with the resources we have. There's no new updates about our status. So far, we have not been cleared to leave. We've heard many rumors on and off over the last few days about test runs and having two people leave, you were just explaining. We were supposed to have two people do a test run on Monday, but that did not, and I haven't heard anything since. So we are currently on standby. We're continuing to do our job. We came here to help the people, to provide medical care and assistance, and we're still here and we're still doing that. We are doing it with the limited supplies that we have, the limited resources that we have. It's tiring, but you know, this is exactly what we need to be doing at this time because they have nothing else. We are kind of their hope here in terms of safety. They feel secure that our presence is here as well as the hospital because of what happened at places like Shifa and Nasser. They feel that as long as there are foreigners here, that they are protected. They are concerned also that what happens when we leave. So we completely understand that it's not just about us leaving. We want to make sure that there's continuous aid coming here and that we are replaced with another team with more supplies and resources so that they feel safe and that we can also make this place function like a hospital.
And doctor, could you compare the situation in other war zones you have been worked in, such as Iraq, to the situation in Gaza right now?
When I was in Iraq, I had the resources of the United States Army behind me. So we had, you know, a combat support hospital. We had multiple specialists. We had a supply chain, even though it might have been limited at some times. We continue to have that. And we were dealing basically with combat. You know, I was dealing with people who got injured because they were either soldiers, combatants. There were civilians that were injured, but it's nothing compared to what I'm seeing right now. 90% of who I see are civilians, and the injuries are just massive.